I'm going to call the committee to order, and we're missing a little bit short of a quorum, I believe. But we'll get started. We have a couple bills before us today. The first one is Representative Dabney. I'm going to welcome you to the committee, Representative Dabney.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon.
And
House File 536, and
be passed and re-referred to. Where do you want it to go, Representative?
Civil law, I believe. Yes, civil law is the word.
Recommend that be passed and sent to civil law.
Okay. All right.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Yes, I guess we're going to have this earlier, and there was a little glitch in paperwork, and we're glad we got you here today. So.
Not as glad as I am to be here today. House File 536 deals with contracts for deed and reforms and updates the statute on contracts for deed. Traditionally, this has been a useful tool often for one-to-one purchases. I have a home. I want to sell it to my child. They may not be able to qualify for a traditional mortgage. I sell it to them on a contract for deed basis, and it works for me and it works for them. Unfortunately, we have seen some changes in the use of contract for deed since 2007. Start thinking about the collapse of the housing market and changes resulting from that. Recorded contracts for deed have risen 55% in Hennepin County and 30% in Ramsey County. So, sharp increase in contracts for deed being used as a strategy. That may or may not be an issue, but we seem to be moving away noticeably from that one-to-one, I own a property and I'm selling it to you, to I'm now selling multiple properties. And we're seeing the multiple seller emerge, and this become more of a business than a one-to-one transaction, with some actors selling 10, 20, 30, and in one case even 75 homes on a contract for deed basis, at which point it starts to be a different thing than what it was previously.
Dabney, let me interrupt you for just a second.
Certainly.
You have a delete everything amendment, so
I do.
I'm going to move that.
My apologies.
To put it in the order that the author wants. That's the DE2 amendment. I'll just quickly vote on that. Everyone in favor of the DE2 amendment being added as a delete everything to House File 536, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Now you have
you
your,
catching that.
You have your
Sure.
delete everything.
Thank you. The Star Tribune recently did an investigative piece on this increasing use of contract for deed by multiple sellers and seemed to be finding some abuses in the system where the buyer does not appreciate what it is they're purchasing. Sometimes they appear to have been misled with these being advertised as lease opportunities when in fact they're a purchase opportunity. And of course, as members of this committee would know, many of the protections that you get when you purchase through a mortgage, usually representation by a realtor, title inspection, appraisal, things like that, don't always exist or often exist in a contract for deed transaction. So, what does the bill do in terms of updating and reforming the contract for deed process? It requires multiple sellers in the contract for deed business to provide disclosure, advising buyers to know exactly what they're getting into and seek the advice of a lawyer or the home ownership center to get an appraisal and an inspection. So making sure that the buyer knows what it is they're buying. Gives the buyer some time to think about it. There's no point in providing a disclosure and then saying, okay, here's some good ideas, things you should do before you sign. Oh, by the way, sign now. You need to have some time elapse between those two events. Provides remedies for failure to provide the disclosure. Removes a criminal penalty for failure to record the contract for deed that has been on the buyer's side. Gives commerce more enforcement clout and gives a buyer harmed by an unscrupulous seller the right to have his or her day in court after the cancellation period expires. The bill does not do anything to prevent contract for deed transactions. We recognize that they're a legitimate and valuable strategy for home ownership for some buyers. It does not apply where the buyer is represented by a realtor. It does not impact the marketability of the title to the property, nor does it affect transactions executed before the effective date of the statute. Legal Aid brought me this bill after their work with clients in contract for deed situations, and with me today is Mr. Ron Elwood from the Minnesota Legal Services Advocacy Project.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I want to thank Representative Dabney for bringing this bill forward. Also want to thank counsel and staff of this committee for helping us to get to the hearing today. And we have certainly seen not just a few, but a significant number of cases where the protections and the changes that we're making here would certainly help. I think there was a range of things that we had been considering and that I think we could have done, but I think this is a fairly modest approach to simply even up the knowledge base between the buyers and sellers, because I think what we always want is an informed buyer, an informed seller entering into a contract and the meeting of the minds, and that's really the underlying intent of this, is to make sure that everybody knows what they're getting themselves into. I also really, really want to thank the Minnesota Realtors Association and the Minnesota State Bar Association, with which we have had numerous discussions, and the delete all that you see here before you today is a product of some lengthy discussions with them resolving concerns that they have up to this point. And there will likely be a couple more tweaks that we're still going to need to make, and we would do that in the appropriate committee in the next stop, which I believe would be is it civil law? All right.
Civil law.
I thought Charlotte wanted to go to judiciary, but either way, you know best. So
we're taking your guidance. If you needed to go to one or the other, we'll follow your lead.
Right, but I think
Charlotte, we think it's civil law, but.
Well, anyway, so with that, happy to answer questions. Obviously, staff is knows what they're doing.
Questions? The author? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Clerk. Chair, do we have representation from either of those, from the bar or from the Minnesota Realtors today, to speak to that directly?
Actually, let's see if we do. Looks like we may. Yes. Ryan Hamilton, Association of Realtors, welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself on the tape, please.
Hi. Madam Chair and members, my name is Ryan Hamilton. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Our 17,000 members throughout the state of Minnesota are licensed real estate professionals who are engaged in the marketplace working with buyers and sellers every day. I'd like to thank Mr. Elwood and Legal Aid for reaching out to us early in the legislative process and allowing us to provide feedback on this proposal. I'll start with this. Realtors believe that contract for deed in and of itself is a long-standing, credible, and useful financing option for buyers. Our goal from the outset has been to ensure that any reform measures are narrowly tailored and do not place willing, ready, and informed contract for deed buyers at a disadvantage in the marketplace. With that in mind, we felt the bill as introduced was overly broad and failed to account for a number of practical considerations. But as Mr. Elwood alluded to, we had some good conversations, and the DE amendment that's before you addresses many of our concerns. At the same time, realtors hope we can continue to work with Mr. Elwood and the author, Representative Dabney, as we move to the next committee. Our goal will continue to be to prevent unintended consequences, and we don't want any negative impacts on willing, informed buyers. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Follow-up, Chair. Any other questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you articulate some of your concerns that are ongoing right now?
Sure. Our concerns would mirror those of the Bar Association in terms of we don't want anything that would cloud title. That'd be the primary one at this point.
Representative O'Neill? Are you done? Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the DeLeo Amendment, it looks kind of like a disclosure, things you should do, shouldn't do. I bought a few things, and you just get a lawyer to guide you through the process. On line 2.24, written in at least 12-point type, to me it seems like a nice idea, but do we, Representative Devi, do we need this for to be in statute?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Anderson. I think we do. Not everyone is represented by a lawyer in these transactions. You may have been. That's certainly good. Well, counsel is the wrong, no pun intended. That's good counsel, but not everyone is. So a recommendation that, hey, this really is a complicated transaction. You really are taking on some significant responsibilities without some of the protections that your neighbors are going to enjoy who bought using a traditional mortgage. You better know that is good. The 12-point type, I understand, but it just assures that you can actually read it. Nobody wants the you ever get those unsolicited credit card transactions in the mail?
Never read them.
Yeah, well, you can't read them. You can't read them, and we don't want that here either. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative O'Neill?
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, read the article several months ago with the Star and Tribune, and I'd just like to point out that a 55% increase in the use of contract for deeds, given a relatively small number of contract for deeds that are recorded in Hennepin County, 1.2 million people residing, is not really a significant increase in my mind. Typically, I think the story quoted about 700 or 800 transactions typical in a year, and 55% increase of that would be just a few hundred more transactions. And given the mortgage crisis that we've had, the recession, and the number of individuals who have had their credit scarred and finding it difficult in order to obtain financing, and sellers willing to provide contract for deed financing is a tool that was widely used in 1980s, early 1980s, when mortgage interest rates went to 13%, 14%, 15%, 16%. Contract for deeds were something that were broadly used, and I hope that we're not going down a path which is going to make contract for deeds and the use of contract for deeds as an optional financing tool for some families something that's more difficult and encumbered and able to get done. I think our overall goal has been to increase home ownership and to increase housing opportunities. That's what this committee is about. And we need not lose sight of the importance of these contract for deed tools. I would also point out that in most existing financing transactions in which a property is encumbered, they have, in most cases, a due on sale clause, which means that it's really a rare number of individuals that are able to offer contract for deeds, because in most cases they're free and clear properties. And so they are acting as the bank. And I just hope that we can avoid the rhetoric of making it sound as though there's all sorts of unscrupulous players in the marketplace, because for the most part, being a member of the real estate community, the contract for deeds have been a valuable tool for certain circumstances, and oftentimes they're even used as secondary financing tools to carry a residual contract balance, even subordinating their interest to other interests. So those are some of my comments. Gentleman, I forgot your name.
Hamilton?
No, the attorney.
Oh, Ron Elwood. With
Mr.
Yes,
Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. We've had a conversation in my office, and I don't for the most part feel that having some additional disclosure is genuinely too onerous, and the realty industry has really been most forthright with offering disclosure after disclosure after disclosure. The only thing that it just, you know, is making all transactions more cumbersome, right down to the point. Maybe getting a little off track here, but I mean, it's even now a realtor's responsibility to do methamphetamine disclosures and child molester disclosures, and it's disclosure after disclosure. And what used to be relatively unencumbered process of conveying property now results in purchase agreements and disclosure notices that are a phone book thick. So, you know, and the other temptation is to resist the idea that people are just too dumb to know what they're doing. I have more respect for people who are entering into real estate transactions, and in every one of the standardized MAR, Minnesota Association of Realtor contracts, there's always a disclosure on the bottom to seek competent legal advice. So those are just my comments. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Elwood. Madam Chair and Representative Pertas, I really appreciate those comments. And I think working with the realtors, we're trying to fulfill the very goals that you're suggesting. I'd also just like to point out a couple of things that I think address some of the concerns. First of all, this does not apply unless you've sold four or more contracts for deed in a 12-month period. So the kind of the classic one-to-one transaction and even one-to-three transaction, it would not apply. None of this would apply. That's number one. And number two, we worked hard with the realtors to ensure that this would be also not applicable if the buyer is represented by a realtor. So I think we've tried to make it as narrowly crafted as we can to address the problems that we have been seeing now since 2008 or 9. There's been a significant number of folks coming through our doors. And while I agree with you that many people are well-informed when they enter into transactions, I can tell you from our experience with enough folks to make this, to warrant us to come to you and ask you to pass this bill. That's why we're here. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, okay. House File 536 as amended is before us, and it'll be, the motion is to pass it and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law.
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
I would.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay, division has been called.
Can you read the...
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
This is division, not a roll
call. Oh.
Oh, I thought you asked for a roll call.
No.
Sorry, division. I'm so sorry. All those in favor, raise your hands.
Madam Chair, there was not an opportunity provided for me to make a closing statement.
I'm so sorry.
Okay, if I could, please.
I will just withhold, recall. I mean, I'm going to take back the vote for the moment, and we'll let you make a statement. I apologize. That was my
quite all right, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I do think we've worked hard on this bill to strike a balance, recognizing that contracts for deed historically have been an effective tool, allowing many people to access home ownership. We certainly do want to continue home ownership as an opportunity, including for low-income folks and those for whom, after the battering of this last recession, they've not been able to access traditional forms of financing, such as a mortgage. But we also want to ensure that with the changing marketplace, where we're seeing more and more multiple sellers, that's not the traditional contract for deed settlement that we're used to, or market that we're used to, and some additional direction to people to receive competent counsel if they're not already represented by a realtor, to have some time between the notice and signing the final contract, and have a deeper understanding of the consequences of what they're taking on, because we want people not only to achieve home ownership, we want them to retain home ownership. And I believe that House File 536, particularly as amended with the good work of the Bar and the Realtors Association and Legal Aid, does strike that proper balance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, there has been a division. Oh, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, as I understand, we've already taken the vote. Is that correct?
We did take the vote, yes. And we're doing a division because I misunderstood. I apologize. We'll do the division. So we're going to have a raising of hands. All of those in favor of moving House File 536, please raise your hands.
Madam Chair, isn't this a division of the vote we have already taken?
Yes, that's right, and that's what happens when a division is to clarify the division of a vote that's already been taken. That's exactly.
Well, we have one member here now who was not here for the original vote.
I don't think that matters. I've never heard of it mattering, but if you want us to, do you want to contest the vote? Okay. Okay. So... Okay. All those who oppose House File 536, please raise your hands. Vote is 7-6. The motion passes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Pardon me?
They counted him against, even though he voted for it.
I'm sorry. Did we miscount?
No.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, could you please explain what just happened?
Okay. My understanding of what happened is we had the vote, yeah, and two things happened. One is I misunderstood. I thought it was a roll call. It was a division, so we decided to do that. And the chief author of the amendment asked to make a statement, which I allowed. And the final vote, by a raising of hands, was 7-6. Is there a problem with that?
I guess I would like it noted that we had an additional member voting the second time than we did the first time. I would like that noted in the record.
No problem. We'll make sure that's noted in the record. Representative Green.
Madam Chair, just as watching this around the table, I think that Representative Anderson raised his hand to ask a question. I'm wondering if he was counted as a yes vote and then a no vote also.
No, no, he was not.
Okay.
Then it would have been 8-6. Or 8-5, correct. Any further discussion about the procedure or anything else? If not, okay. Thank you, Representative Dabney. And Representative Fisher, do you want to... Oh, are you going to... Could you go back? Okay, do you want to take
that?
Okay, all right. I'm getting some advice here just to make sure everything is absolutely correct. Representative Anderson, I want you to hear this too. Representative Dabney, to make sure that your bill isn't burdened with any questionable vote.
All right.
The advice to me from our counsel is to move to reconsider so that we will have it clear that everyone who's here and voting is here and voting. Okay. So Representative Isaacson moves that we reconsider the vote. So we have to vote on that motion.
Representative Anderson didn't hear any of this.
We are, Representative Anderson, I will just explain to you again. Just to make it clear that Representative Dabney's bill will move forward without any question in the procedure, because I understand you have some questions. There's a motion to reconsider the vote, and we're going to vote on that motion to reconsider. We'll do that first, and then based on what that decision is, then we will take the vote again. Okay, is that clear to everybody? Representative Isaacson moves to reconsider the motion by which we voted this bill. So all of those in favor of voting for the reconsideration, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is your committee. You can do as you choose, but I'm not so sure it's correct to allow a closing statement after a vote has been taken. That would be my contention right now, that that closing statement allowed another member to come, and that would be my contention.
Representative Anderson, you're probably right. I was trying to give a courtesy to our author. And I'm going to give that to any author, no matter who it was. But you're right, it's not usually the way it's done. Now we have the motion before us to reconsider the vote. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of the motion to reconsider the vote indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. We will now reconsider the vote. And Representative Isaacson, you want to make sure, actually, I think it was Representative Bly's motion to pass
House I'll renew my motion.
House Bill 536 as amended and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No?
No.
Okay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
You're on your way to civil law.
Okay, we'll next be hearing House File number 1344 from Representative Clark. If you'd like to move your bill, and will this be for layover, or will this be going on
Mr.
to...
Mr. Chair, this is to move the bill to be laid over.
Okay, this
possible
is...
Possible consideration on this bill.
Representative Clark moves her House File 1344 for being laid over. Representative Clark, if you'd like to explain the bill to us, please.
Yes, I'm going to be very brief because I see we have quite a few witnesses who'd like to testify. This is the governor's housing finance bill. And basically, you'll notice that what we're doing here is asking, the governor has recommended a $13 million one-time increase over the base funding for MHFA, and he's suggesting some specific places where we would be making those changes. One is a $10 million in the Housing Challenge Fund. Another is the $2 million for Highly Mobile Students Initiative, and also $1 million for a reentry initiative for ex-offenders to secure more stable housing. Then there's a reallocation from PAREF to the Rehabilitation Loan Fund. We've heard this bill basically before, members. We're just going to be going over, I guess, ground that you already hopefully have had a lot of time to think about. And I'll start by asking Commissioner Tinkerthal to just review briefly, if she would, and call her the witnesses I believe that you've asked to come forward.
Thank you, Representative Clark and Mr. Chair. We are here again today to talk about the governor's proposed budget bill for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for the next biennium. You should have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation at your places, as well as a presentation overview. Slide number two simply restates the budget, which we discussed with you before. As Representative Clark stated, there is one reallocation from the line item for preservation or PAREF to single family rehabilitation loans. And just a reminder that the reason for this change is that we have chosen to use a federal funding source under the Federal Home Program to fund the preservation activity because it is a fairly compliance heavy program. And the Rehabilitation Loan Program are very small loans to very low-income families that just don't lend themselves very well to a lot of heavy federal compliance. Also, in the third column of numbers are the one-time initiatives, and we'll be hearing from Representative Casilius and Deputy Commissioner Solheid today about those two initiatives. Moving on to the budget presentation overview, which you should have in front of you, we do have a number of speakers today. We thought, since you had heard from me previously, that you might like to hear from some of the folks that are actually implementing these programs on the ground, and also who know the people that benefit from these programs out in the community. We have four different areas today, development, redevelopment, preservation, which covers the challenge program and the PARIF program, home ownership programs, our home ownership assistance fund and our counseling program, rehabilitation programs, rehab loans for single family we'll be hearing about today, and then our supportive housing and homelessness prevention programs, including the rent assistance initiatives, totaling $89,096,000. I would first like to introduce to my left Paul Fate, who is CEO of Common Bond Communities. Paul?
Mr. Fate?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be with you today. My name is Paul Fate, and I am the president of Common Bond Communities. We are a 42-year-old organization that has built or rehabbed 5,300 units of housing. About 65% of that's family, 30 senior, and about 5% are people of various special needs. I'm going to give you, we have been the beneficiaries of some very critical funds from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, both the Challenge Grant funding and the PARIF funding. Our organization does both preservation, which implies acquisition and rehab, as well as new construction. I'm going to give you examples of one of each of these. The development you see in front of you is called Vicksburg Commons in Plymouth. This is 50 units of new construction for families. This is 2 and 3 bedroom units, and it has proven to be critical housing for what we call workforce families, working families. One example is a young woman that we have had talk at some of our events, Lanier, who is a single mom with 2 kids working as a dental hygienist, really found that the housing she had available to her was too expensive, it was unsafe, and she was not able to really stabilize her family situation. This housing is indeed stabilizing her family situation. The kids are doing very well in school. You should know that Common Bond has something that we call advantage centers tied to our housing, which are focused on kids and school success, adults and economic success, and seniors living in place, aging in place, with the highest quality of life possible. So Lanier has indeed had a very successful tenure here and has gotten a new and better job as a result. Her kids are thriving in school. We do know that housing stability has everything to do with kids succeeding in school. The second example is a acquisition rehab preservation of housing in Oakdale on the east side of our metro area. And this is 68 units of family housing. Again, this was housing that had fallen in serious disrepair, had really become a liability in the community rather than an asset. And we raised the funds to be able to do a total reconstruction and add a new advantage center for the families. This is large family housing with primarily three bedrooms. And we were able to use the challenge funding here, again, to be able to make this development work. These developments would not have worked but for the availability of challenge funds in each case. Finally, I want to just mention that on the PARIF side of things, for every $4 in federal funding, for every dollar of state funding, we are indeed preserving $4 in federal funding through the PARIF program, which is a very good rate of return. And Common Bond, over its history, has been able to preserve nearly 3,000 units of housing, preserving very critical rent subsidy programs like Section 8 and also the Section 202 program as a result. And again, but for the PARIF program, we would not be able to do this. So Common Bond prides itself in building quality, dignified housing with life-changing services. We simply could not be successful at what we do without these kinds of critical dollars from Minnesota Housing, and in this case, particularly the challenge and PARIF dollars. So thank you very much for allowing me to speak today.
Any questions for Mr. Fate? Hearing none, well, let's move on to our next testifier. We have Mr. Eric Odernis.
And as Mr. Odernis is joining us from Lake Area Mortgage, I did want to mention that on your table presentation overview, you'll see the in italics the Housing and Jobs Growth Initiative. We spoke at some length about this the last time I was before the committee, and just to remind you that this is a proposal by the governor for an additional $10 million one time to the Challenge Fund to develop housing in communities with a growing workforce and a shortage of housing. And the photo we have here occurred shortly after I was here last time, and that is a meeting that we held in Roseau, Minnesota with Governor Dayton, and we had fairly lengthy meetings with representatives from Polaris and Marvin Windows and talked about ways in which we might work together not only with dollars from this initiative but several other tactics as well. So we are having discussions about relieving this pressure in some of these communities and hope that you will consider that as well. And with that, I'd like to introduce Eric Odernis from Lake Area Mortgage.
Mr. Odernis.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Eric Odernis. I am a residential mortgage loan officer for a company called, small company called Lake Area Mortgage in Shoreview. We're owned by Lake Area Bank. The lake in the name is White Bear Lake. I've been doing this business since 1995. Prior to that, I was a realtor going back to 1983. And most of my work has been in the first-time homebuyer area. I've always been helping the first-time homebuyer first-time homebuyers generally get their first house in Minnesota, using the Minnesota housing programs extensively all these years. They've been around a long time. I was asked to speak about two specific things that Minnesota Housing does, the down payment assistance and supporting the first-time homebuyer classes, the home stretch classes that first-time homebuyers are required to take before they can get the first-time homebuyer program. I'm a guest speaker at a number of the providers of the first-time homebuyer programs, and I can tell you from personal experience that folks come out of those classes, not just the ones that I'm a guest speaker at, but all of them, or many of them, with good reviews, specifically stating that they had a good time at the class, they learned something, and it was valuable information. Even folks in my industry, the famously skeptical mortgage underwriters, think of the first-time homebuyer class certificate as a compensating factor in the file, and it's known that people who take the first-time homebuyer class have a better chance of being successful homeowners, and underwriters like to see that certificate in the file. As to the down payment assistance, which provided by Minnesota Housing is anywhere from 3 to 5% of the price of the house, they asked me to come up with a specific example, and that's very hard to do when, you know, I help 3 or 4 people per month, and my office probably 20 people per month with the down payment assistance programs, which, I mean, if they weren't there, of course, these people would be very unlikely to be able to get that first house. I remember back to my first house, which I bought in 1978, was a young single carpenter and was able to, as a young single carpenter, save up enough money to buy that first house. Years later, as a third-time home buyer with a wife and 3 small children, had I not had a chance to start out with that first house, I don't know how I could have saved up $7,000, which is what it cost me to put down on my third house. I don't know how I could have saved that up had I not had a chance to start out as a first-time home buyer many years earlier. I don't know about you guys, but when I had a wife and 3 small kids, the idea of saving that kind of money out of my paychecks was a pretty tough thing. So I don't have any specific examples of that, but believe me, we help probably 20 people per month in my small office get into their first homes with this program. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Very quickly, before I move forward, I do want to make one announcement. We've just been notified that anyone here for House File 8 that has been pulled from the agenda, we will not be hearing that at this session. So just want to make sure if there's anyone in the audience waiting for House File 8, we will not be hearing it now. And then were there any questions for our testifier? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Otterness, you say you deal with a lot of folks in the area of first-time home buyers. Do any of those involve contracts for deed?
Mr. Otterness.
Mr. Chair? As a mortgage loan officer, I wouldn't be involved in contract for deeds because contract for deeds are their own type of financing. If I give them mortgages to buy them, I'm only involved in mortgages, first mortgages to buy houses.
Okay, thank you.
Does that make sense?
Any further questions? Hearing none, why don't we move on? Commissioner Tinkerthal, would you like to introduce our next testifier?
Yes, we'll now be hearing from Suzanne Snyder, Program Director for the Greater Metropolitan Housing Corporation. And as Suzanne comes to join us to talk about our homeowner rehabilitation program, I also wanted to mention that the challenge program that you heard about from Paul Fate is also used in our single family area, particularly for foreclosure remediation activities. And I understand that members of this committee did take a tour a week or so ago and saw some of the houses in Frogtown that had been rehabilitated with challenge funds in our single family program. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Suzanne Snyder.
Ms. Snyder,
thank you
for coming.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you this afternoon. My name is Suzanne Snyder. I'm the program director at the Greater Metropolitan Housing Corporation. GMHC was founded in 1970 to increase the availability and the quality of affordable housing for very low income and moderate income families and individuals in the Minneapolis area. Today, more than 40 years later, we are providing housing opportunities and services throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We act as a developer of single-family housing. We support the development of affordable rental housing with pre-development loan funds. And we provide secondary financing of government programs. And I would like to talk with you specifically this afternoon about Minnesota Housing's Rehabilitation Loan Program. We are an administrator of the Rehab Loan Program, and that program serves very low-income families, most of whom earn less than $25,000 a year. One-third of the homeowners assisted are senior citizens. With the Rehab Loan Program, we are able to help homeowners with basic home improvements in the areas of health and safety, energy efficiency, and even accessibility improvements for those that have physical limitations in order to allow them to remain in their homes. This is a critical program to allow people to remain in their homes, often that which is most desirable and cost-effective, particularly for very low-income homeowners, but we want them to remain in those homes in a healthy and safe environment. For example, I'd like to tell you about one woman we worked with recently. Her name is Annie. She's a senior citizen who's a widow living in a mobile home. Her annual income is less than $16,000. Annie had a bad roof. She had water damage to her interior walls as a result of the leaky roof. She had an old electric water heater, and the element on the water heater kept going out. It would burn out regularly, and every time she had to pay money to have a technician come in and replace that heating element. In addition, her home was no longer level. Because of the freezing and drying that we have in Minnesota, her home, her mobile home, tilted such that her back door could not open, which is, of course, a fire hazard. So with the Rehab Loan Program, we were able to put a new roof on her home. We repaired the interior walls. We installed an Energy Star rated gas water heater for her, and we leveled the home. And when we did that, we replaced her front and back doors with heavier, more secure doors. The state appropriations are the most important source of financial assistance for very low income homeowners. These are not people that can go to the bank and get a conventional loan in order to make improvements. These people do not have disposable income in order to make these improvements. And without the rehab loan program, we at GMEIC would not have the tools to be able to help these families and individuals. Thank you very much.
Okay, any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. I'll try again. Ms. Snyder, does your organization deal with the contracts for deed when you work with home buyers?
Ms. Snyder.
Well, we do. And this program allows us to work with people who have a contract for deed. That's a form of ownership that is acceptable.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So just asking your opinion, do you feel it's necessary to put into statute a reminder for folks to get legal counsel when they enter into a contract for deed?
Ms. Snyder.
Well, I certainly don't think it would hurt to have a reminder to seek counsel.
Representative Anderson, any? Okay. Representative Green.
I just have one. You refer to these as loans.
Yes.
How many are paid back?
Ms. Snyder.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the loans are 0% deferred. It means there are no monthly payments on the loans, and there is no interest accrued. If the homeowner remains in their home, if it's a single-family home, for 15 years, the loan is forgiven. For a mobile home, it's forgiven after 10 years. If they do not remain in their home for the prescribed period of time, then the loan is due upon sale.
Representative Green.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I am aware of that. I guess my question was, are any of them, you know, does any money ever come back in from them?
Ms. Snyder.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, when money is repaid, it is repaid to the State Housing Finance Agency. The loans are closed in our name and then assigned to the agency.
Commissioner Tinkerfell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has received state appropriations for this program. It's had a couple of different names, but literally since 1976, so there have been a fair number of these made over time. We do record a lien on the property, and my recollection is that there are repayments, given that very long history, of roughly about $1 million a year that come back and are recycled into this program. That's the only use that they can be used for, is to make loans under this program. I might also add that this is a program that we virtually never are able to make it through the entire year with funding. We maybe have, we can maybe meet 4 months of demand in a given 12-month period, because this really is for the very lowest income homeowners who often have nowhere else to turn. And it's really quite cost effective in that, you know, if people had to move out of their houses because they didn't have a functioning furnace or some other dire problem with the home, they would probably go into some form of, you know, particularly the elderly, some form of assisted housing. So it may sound like a lot coming back in, but it's from off of a very large portfolio of loans.
Thank you. Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, Commissioner Tinkerthaw, would you like to call up introduce our next testifier, please?
Yes, I'd like to introduce Mikkel Beckman from St. Stephen's Human Services to talk about our three supportive housing and homeless prevention programs. And again, those of you who may have been on the tour last week, Two projects that received funding from these sources would include the Higher Ground project that you saw in downtown Minneapolis and the Nicollet Square project, which was for homeless youth in South Minneapolis. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mikkel. Thank you.
Mr.
Beckman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mikkel Beckman. I'm the executive director at St. Stephen's Human Services. We are a community-based nonprofit in Minneapolis. We are part of the statewide effort to end chronic homelessness that was launched under the Plenty administration, which continues under this administration. And we are part of the Hennepin County Heading Home Hennepin Plan, the plan to end homelessness within 10 years in Hennepin County. There are these plans all throughout the state. There are only two counties in Minnesota that aren't somehow involved in a 10-year plan to end homelessness, and so these efforts are going on all around the state. The mission of St. Stephen's is to end homelessness. We have a variety of programs related to employment and housing. There's only two ways to make the math work to end somebody's homelessness: raise their income or lower the cost of the housing. We try to do both. Specifically, the programs to end chronic homelessness that we utilize from Minnesota Housing, I'd like you to know, first of all, we have reduced chronic homelessness in my community over 40% with the use of some of these other tools, and especially these subsidies. I'll give you one example. A lot of the people we work with have incomes much less than $7,000 a year, annual incomes. We're talking about incredibly low-income people with pretty profound disabilities. Many of the chronically homeless, who only make up about 15% of the total homeless, but use about 60 to 70% of the resources in any community, suffer from pretty profound mental illness. We're all about the first person at St. Stephen's, so I'm going to tell you this brief story in the first person. This is a woman named Fern, who's 64 years old. She was homeless for 3 years in Minneapolis. She says, "I had a grocery cart that carried my belongings. It held my blankets and plastic. I had a camp stove I made from a V8 can. I'd grease up my hair and throat with Vicks and put a plastic bag over it and two hats even in the summer so I didn't get sick or get lice. I wasn't the cleanest and I wasn't the best smelling, and part of that was my protection from assaults. St. Stephen's and this housing program saved my life. I want people to know I was a 64-year-old woman who lived on the streets without drugs, without alcohol, without prostitution, and my life was saved. I never felt invisible because I always felt like someone was looking out for me. People would bring me soup, a bottle of water, a piece of fruit, so I knew people cared. Others would sit and visit. Some would even let their children hug me because they knew I needed love. My apartment is light and airy and it's cozy. There used to be nights I would go by houses and I'd see the lights on in there and I'd say to myself, people in there are warm and cozy, and then I'd tell myself, I can't have that yet." So we effectively use resources from the state to help end chronic homelessness, and that's happening all throughout the state, and it's a really effective program. What it helps to do is it also leverages private, faith-based, and philanthropic dollars so that we can build an actual program around, because it's not just rental assistance that helps somebody. It's having a relationship with somebody and working with them and moving them to a better place. And so we take the subsidies we use and the rental assistance from the state, leverage faith-based, private, corporate, philanthropic dollars, build an actual program that's human to human, and it profoundly is changing the face of homelessness for the better in our community. On the other end of the spectrum, we also have people who, because of temporary situations, may end up homeless. These are folks who may have temporarily a job loss, a hospital bill they can't afford, a car breakdown. And so we use the FHPAP dollars, as they're called, Family Homeless Planning Prevention dollars from the state, to help prevent people from ending up in publicly funded shelters and trying to keep the lid on family homelessness right now. And so we use these dollars for one-time rental assistance or a mortgage payment for a month to keep people housed so they don't have to leave their housing, don't have to go to a shelter, don't have to have their kids uprooted from the school they're in and all of this. And it's expensive to keep people in publicly funded shelter. It's much less expensive to give them a one-time infusion of rental assistance so that they can stay in their apartment or in their home until such time that they're back on their feet and they have their own income coming into the house again. So those are just a couple of examples. Last year, we helped 738 households rapidly exit shelter with FHPAP dollars and 206 singles. We helped prevent 168 families from becoming homeless. and 117 single adults from becoming homeless through the prevention programs. And again, we do the same thing. We use the rental assistance, but we leverage other dollars from the community to build actual programs that work for people, and it's quite an effective source of funds for us at St. Stephen's. And I think that's all I wanted to tell you today.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Beckman. Are there any questions for Mr. Beckman? Seeing none, Commissioner Tinkerthal, if you'd like to introduce our next testifier, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I do that, I want to remind the committee of two things that we talked about last time. One is that our rental assistance program, providing permanent supportive housing for individuals such as Mr. Beckman just talked about, costs about $500 a month for the period of time that people are receiving rental assistance. And that compares to the cost of that same person spending a month in an emergency shelter, on the floor, and that cost would be over $1,000 a month. So permanent supportive housing really is a cost-effective solution in reducing the number of people who need to use shelters. I'd also like to remind the committee that the Housing Trust Fund, which has base budgeting of a little over $19 million for the biennium, is used predominantly for rental assistance. We used it in earlier years for bricks and mortar, but now it is used mostly for rental assistance. And it was in drawing off of the lessons learned from that program, where we have a significant network of program deliverers around the state, that we developed the idea that you will hear about next for a rental assistance program for highly mobile students. And with that, I introduce Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius.
Commissioner Caselius. Welcome.
Chairman and members, thank you so much for hearing this testimony today, and thank you, Commissioner Tinkerthal, for your leadership in this area. I wanted to just start with just a brief personal story. I'm actually a product of public housing. I grew up in the Glendale Projects in Southeast Minneapolis, and then when my mother and father tried to reconcile and then separated again in high school while I was there, my mother was able to have rental assistance and help from your agency, and so I'm very thankful for it, and I know what a hand up for families can do to help children out of poverty. I want to just speak in support of this bill and how it impacts children and their continuity of education, to their attendance rates, to their achievement rates, and how important it is for us in this state in terms of our achievement gaps that we have. We know to have a great workforce in Minnesota, children need the best education possible. And that comes with stable housing, stable families. And this supportive element is one piece to helping us close achievement gaps. And I'm so appreciative that the governor, in his wisdom, as well as with the support and guidance and leadership of Commissioner Tinkerthal, are thinking in this holistic manner for children and families as we try to address achievement gaps. Specifically, this rental assistance will help, especially in this tough economic time when school districts are having difficulty providing resources as well to students. It's very, very important that students have this stability in their housing because transportation costs can be so expensive for school districts when families do move. We also know that with achievement, when students move, that for them to catch up, it can take anywhere from 4 to 6 months for them to regain that lost information that they had. So moving school to school to school is very challenging for students. This will impact just a small number of students, this investment, but for every one student, as I can attest from me, my own personal experience, it makes a huge, big difference for that family and for that child. It reminds me of the starfish story that many of you have heard, where the child's walking on the beach and throwing starfish back, and someone says, you know, why are you throwing all those starfish? It's just not going to make a difference. And he throws it in and says it made a difference for that one. And so I think that this is a small investment. It's a pilot. I think that they'll be evaluating this investment, and there's things we can learn from in the public schools about how we use our funding to help support families in the achievement of their children. So I wanted to just speak to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the commissioner?
Yeah.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know which commissioner you're talking about.
I'm sorry. Wait. Commissioner Casilius.
Thank you. No, not right now.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Casilius, for coming in. And then Commissioner Tinkerthal, if you'd like to introduce our next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have one final speaker today, and that is Deputy Commissioner of Corrections Ron Solhide, talking about the other portion of the rental assistance initiative proposed by the governor.
Mr. Solhide.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Solhide. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Community Services at the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of reentry rental assistance housing for rental assistance funds for ex-offenders. This initiative that has been put forth through Minnesota Housing Finance is one of the critical needs of offenders releasing from prison, and it will help us assist them in not returning. Just to give you some information as example, this slide talks about lack of stable housing is one of the five primary factors that influence recidivism. When you consider the others, employment needs, medical, mental health assistance needs, chemical dependency treatment needs, educational and vocational needs of offenders, none of those can be realized without stable housing. It's difficult at best, if not impossible, for ex-offenders to get these other needs addressed if they do not have stable housing. In addition, I'd like to note that of the over 7,000 offenders released from prison each year, we have hundreds and hundreds of offenders who are being released to either shelter care facilities and or to their probation parole agent's office because they lack an approvable residence or lack any residence whatsoever. And so oftentimes those offenders end up in substandard housing and or shelters. And that creates an issue with respect to public safety and the ability of agents to work with offenders to get them stable and get them moving forward in their lives. Not only the offenders, but also their families are impacted by this, these ex-offenders who are trying to get on with their lives. So I'm offering this testimony in support of this initiative, and I'm here to answer any questions that you might have around this issue.
Any questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Representative Zeros.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the Deputy Commissioner. Where are these funds proposed to be used? Is this a statewide initiative? Is this exclusively for the metro area? Where are you looking at for placing some of these folks?
Deputy Commissioner Solhide.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this would be a statewide initiative, and it would be the funding would go through the rental assistance coordinators at Minnesota Housing Finance. So we will work with them to develop the specific criteria and application process for offenders who are being released from prison.
Any other questions? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, when I look at the numbers there and I see the high-end estimation being about $7,000 per year annually and the estimation for the individuals being at 90 individuals. If you take the 90 individuals and multiply it by the $7,000 per annual part there, the number, how does that relate to the $1 million that's being requested for this?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher. This is rental assistance, so it's a portion of their income, so it's difficult to determine exactly how much somebody will be requiring in assistance. Many offenders who come out are finding employment, but oftentimes it's low-wage employment, so this would just be in addition to their income.
Commissioner Tinkerthal.
Yes, if I could add a comment. It's $5,500 to $7,000 annually, and this is a two-year program. So it's really, you know, if the same person utilized the rental assistance for 2 years, it'd be more like $11,000 per year. So 11,000 times 90 is roughly $1 million. One of the things we've learned in working with our colleagues at Corrections is that there have been some experimental programs in the past providing maybe 1 or 2 months of rental assistance to the exiting offenders, and that just isn't enough. And so with this program, we've proposed that those exiting ex-offenders have the ability to have rental assistance for up to 2 years. But of course, if that wasn't needed for that length of time, we would be able to serve more individuals.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Representative Green.
Yeah, I just have one, and it could be for anyone up there. A while back, you were telling me, you know, for the funding for the families with children, that you were getting, and elderly, you were getting way more requests than you had money. How many families with small children or elderly could be serviced by this $1 million?
Commissioner Tinkerfell?
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, it would probably be somewhat fewer families, simply because if you have a family with a couple of kids, you're probably going to need a larger housing unit. I haven't really thought of calculating the numbers in that manner, but I would think it would be somewhat fewer, just because it would probably be more than about the 500 a month that we've estimated for the ex-offenders.
Any further questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Okay, any further questions for Commissioner Tinkerthal while we have her here? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Commissioner, we were out and saw the on our housing tour last week, and the need is there for affordable housing and rental assistance. So in this rental assistance program, the $2 million left for families, is that sufficient to cover the need out there for what the community and what the state needs?
Commissioner Tinkerfell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no, this would not come anywhere near the level of need for families that really are paying an exorbitant amount or living in a very poor location. The reason we proposed it at the level we did, we thought that this level of funding would give us a good pilot program, one that I believe at the last meeting testified to you, we intend to seek some assistance from the philanthropic community to do a good evaluation of this program and the impact. There have recently been some studies published that track kids who received stable housing some 10 years ago, and their improvement in school performance, that's a long time to track, but we feel that this is such a fundamental way of providing stability for families that it would be a good time to start now to see if we really can make a difference for families by providing them with a stable place to live. So it's really not even attempting to meet the entire need, but really to focus in on families where we think the payback to society and to the state would be very large by providing stability for these kids.
Any further questions for the commissioner? Seeing none, I understand there might be somebody else that might be interested in testifying on this bill in the audience, if they'd like to come up at this point, or if there's anyone else that's interested in testifying. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Commissioner, did you have a few more slides you wanted to cover first?
I apologize. Yes, Mr. Chair. Just in summary, we sometimes are asked of how many households do we touch in a given year. Last year, through the various programs that you've just heard about, we provided about $638 million for housing. Much of that is federal funding for rental assistance, and that served about 63,000 households. Our renters tend to be very low income, and that's why they're receiving rental assistance. Our home buyers tended to have an annual income of under $45,000, and as you heard from Mr. Otterness, we're able to do that successfully by providing both down payment assistance and, importantly, the home buyer counseling. And we're also very proud that 23% of the households that were first-time home buyers last year were households of color, and that compares to about a 16% level in the normal market. So finally, just reminding you that we think Minnesota Housing, as you consider your many choices for funding this year, really is a smart investment. We have a 40-year track record of success. No state appropriations that you see in front of you are used for operating expenses. Every dollar of appropriations goes directly into programs. And just to remind you, as I testified last time, we cover our operating expenses largely through our single-family lending programs, where we sell tax-exempt bonds and then re-lend those proceeds to home buyers. Investments are made across the state, and they're all made through local businesses, such as the business people that you heard from today. We don't really do any lending directly from Minnesota Housing. We really work to leverage both private and public resources with every state dollar that we utilize. And there are often many savings to the state through supportive housing, as we've talked about, and through our rehabilitation loan program for those very low-income homeowners. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's been a pleasure to appear before you today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Anderson, you have a question.
Not a question, I guess, Mr. Chair, just a comment. Commissioner, I appreciate the job you're doing. And I recall earlier one of our meetings, the slide about making these programs available outstate or throughout the state. And as I recall, my region was like 2.5%, 3.5%, something like that. So I would look forward to seeing some of those outstate numbers increased when we come back again next year.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Seeing no other questions, we have another person who's interested in speaking on the bill. If you could please come forward and introduce yourself to the committee, I would appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, which are shelters in transitional and permanent housing. And I head the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. Much of the population and organizations serve the communities of color that they speak of as far as in need. I particularly want to focus on one area as far as, and Commissioner Thingersall knows we have a problem that's been unresolved in a particular area related to what we call the homeownership counseling program and services. Our request since back in 2009, and some of the legislators have heard over the years, is that we had requested a separation of program dollars from what they call the education and training dollars. The law says that counselors and trainers must be certified, and there are four certifying agencies per the law. One is NeighborWorks America, which was created out of Congress and trains all of HUD people and is the basis of which the Minnesota Homeownership Center bases their home stretch curriculum. The other two other certifiers, they say, are HUD, Minnesota Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Association, and again the Minnesota Homeownership Center. Like I say, they all use the NeighborWorks curriculum as a standard. The HECAP program only pays for the curriculum that Minnesota Home Ownership Center provides and not for NeighborWorks America. So the grantees or the applicants for grants who do not receive it through Minnesota Housing, if they want to be certified and serve, they must take NeighborWorks courses and go out of state for that, which amounts to about $5,000 per course. Which usually they've been the smaller organizations who need the education training dollars versus the large ones who are already usually HUD approved. And if they're HUD approved, HUD pays for the education training and travel. So that was the an ask, was to separate these dollars so the ones who really need it, smaller organizations, don't have to travel out of state to get their certifications. And the larger ones who already are HUD approved, they can have HUD pay for it. The other thing is the counselors who are certified, there's a return on investment on them because they can usually charge the clients for most of what they do counsel or educate clients on. The only one is in foreclosure where HUD says not to charge the client. However, the nonprofits can charge the mortgage lender or a realtor to pay for those fees. So there is a payback system. And even HUD is saying to sustain that program, they're urging programs to look for other sources of funding like this. Now, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is also gets their funds, some of their funds, from NeighborWorks America. However, they don't refer clients who are trained by NeighborWorks America solely, for example, even though I'm a former corporate auditor and I have been doing housing counseling since like 1984, I still have to take the certification classes. However, I'm not in the Minnesota Homeownership Network, as are many other nonprofits, so we don't get client referrals from them. We have to get our clients from out of state or however we can. One of the requirements HUD says is that we have to have a certain quota of clients before we become HUD approved, even though we're certified. So there's this gap between when we're certified and when we get HUD approval, we still can counsel and have clients, but it's just that we don't get the HUD approval where we get money back from HUD. So there's later, as you'll hear about so-called HUD counseling agencies, if you could realize that there's this gap of these in-between people that need to be addressed. And I think also I wanted to raise this issue because we've raised it, that this is a lost resource to consumers when there are many counselors out there who are not in the so-called one-stop shop network to be able to have access to the counselors, and there needs to be some remedy for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, Representative Clark renews her motion for House File 1344 to be laid over. And then just a couple things for the rest of the committee is that, once again, House File 8 has been pulled from the agenda. We will be meeting again this evening starting at 6 o'clock in room 500 North, and we will stand in recess until that point in time. Thank you.
Many members, I'd like to call the meeting to order. We have two bills tonight that we're going to be considering. And I can tell you that my bill, which we're going to be considering first here, looks like we're going to do it as mostly as an informational hearing, because we have an amendment to it that we didn't have in time, so we're going to be just looking at that and sharing the amendment, and then we'll lay it over and finish voting on it on our next meeting. I think we have minutes to approve from March 6th.
I'll move approval.
Representative Fisher moves approval of the minutes March 6th. They should be in your folder. Any discussion? Not. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevailed, and those minutes are approved and adopted. So I will now turn the chair over here.
Okay, Representative Clark moves House File 1055 to be laid over to our next meeting on March 13th. Representative Clark, if you'd like to do the introduction on the bill.
Sure. Thank you, members, for coming back for this evening meeting. I appreciate it. Basically, this bill takes revenue from the existing fund and the two funds, the mortgage and the deed tax, and dedicates it to a housing development fund. The reason we're just laying it over today is because the language in the bill isn't quite right. It's supposed to say housing development fund. And the calculations are, I think, possibly a little bit different. And we'll have Mr. Soderbergh go through that. Should have in your packet, I believe, both a chart that shows the fiscal calculations and the... Do we have the amendment, the A1 amendment in the file? Because it has the dollar figures. See that A1 amendment passed around. And that'll be the correction that we'll put on in our next meeting that explains exactly. So basically, we're saying the mortgage... registry tax and the D-tax are capped at a certain level, and then the excess in the, those funds that come in will then be dedicated to this housing development fund in the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Let me just say that we're going to have some testimony on that. You know, as the chair of this committee, I'm really concerned about how we do find a way to raise the money that we need to spend on affordable housing. We've had a lot of, I think, important testimony about the needs of housing. I can tell you, having been here through many years of housing funds being cut, this is a way to dedicate some funding. And hopefully our leaderships on both sides will think that this is a good idea, and that you yourselves will think that this is a good idea. So I guess I'm going to start by asking some... do you want to go through the just over some of the amendments? Does everybody have the A1 amendment? Those are the numbers that will be amended out of our next year. Do you have that?
A1.
Yeah. Do you want to just take us through that? I think you might have a chart in your as well. Is that right?
Madam Chair, the A1 amendment is conceptually, I think, the best way to describe the amendment to members is to think back when the legislature created a way of paying back the school shift. And what they did is they said any amount over the amount forecasted to come into the general fund and became surplus first went back to pay back the school shift. And what this amendment does is the dollars reflected in the amendment are the forecasted revenues that in the February forecast, the latest revenues that would be collected with the deed tax and the mortgage registration tax. And what it says is the first dollar amount up to the amount forecasted will go to the general fund, as is current law, and any amount over the forecast that may accrue because housing market is stronger than we expected or whatever the case may be would go to the new affordable, the housing trust fund, I guess it's called the affordable housing fund here. So the net effect is that according to the forecast, and if all goes according to the forecast, there'll be no money going into the fund, but any growth over and above the forecast would go to the fund. So that's, so conceptually, just think of how the school shift was paid back. This is a similar concept. It's just a much narrower purpose and a much narrower revenue flow that you would be capturing. It's the growth over forecast for these two, mortgage registration tax and the deed tax. And that's the concept, and that's what the amendment does.
Okay.
Representative Clark?
Members, I guess I would ask, I have a witness who would like to talk a little bit with us about that, and maybe you can introduce yourself.
Sure. And I do have a...
Can you have your testify or identify himself again, please?
Sure. Thank you. Chair, I'm Chip Halbach. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership.
Welcome. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And... if I could have a handout distributed. The Housing Partnership has worked with Representative Clark over years on various approaches to increase revenues for affordable housing. And this is an example of one approach. And what I'm going to speak to the committee tonight is mostly on why some approach is needed. The deed capture or the growth in the deed tax and the mortgage registry tax is in itself not unknown in the world of affordable housing. Several states take this approach in order to bring revenues into the stream of funds that can be used to develop affordable housing. Florida would be the one that has done that the most. And so it is taking a tax that relates to affordable housing or in housing and real estate and without increasing the tax rate, it takes the existing tax, uses the existing tax structure, and takes that revenue and applies to the housing need. The graph that was distributed to the committee gives one way of understanding some of the challenge that we've had. And, you know, this committee, of course, has heard a number of people talk about the lack of affordable housing relative to the need. This bar chart takes the looks at three sets of numbers. The first is the blue bars, which relate to the severe cost burden and how many households in each year in the table, which runs from 2007 through 2011, are added to that population in Minnesota that has a severe cost burden, of renters that have a severe cost burden. And a severe cost burden are households that are paying over 50%, over half their income for housing. And in the field of affordable housing, that relates directly to stress in terms of being able to meet your other household obligations, be it food, medical expenses, transportation, what have you. People who are paying over half their income for housing are really squeezed. So it's not the only indicator, it's one indicator that shows the magnitude of housing need facing the state. Now we, in this chart, we look at that relative to the affordable housing that's being created in the state, both the new affordable rental units and new rental assistance, units of rental assistance, households receiving rental assistance. So, and that comes from all sorts of sources. It comes from federal sources, state sources, local sources, private investment. All of that money adds up to create the red and the green bars on your chart. So what this shows is that, and I should say starting with 2007, we had in Minnesota just for renters approximately 110,000 households across the state that are paying over half their income for housing, renters households paying over half their income for housing. So what happened since that time? Well, in 2007, we actually had more affordable housing and more rental assistance relative to the growth in that need. Now, the need was still there, you know. We didn't take that down much, that 111,000 down much. But it didn't increase because of the state federal investment in that time. We held pretty much even. In 2008, however, even though there were approximately 800-900 new rental units and 800-900 new units of rental assistance, that group, that population of renter households in Minnesota that was already at 111,000 grew by another 2,000. 2009, where we had a big hit from the recession, is where you saw that really shot up. So even though we have a good investment in terms of what other states have had in terms of resources for affordable housing in Minnesota, that need in 2009 increased by another 14,000 households, and that's above these almost 1,000 units of production of affordable rental housing and about 500 new Section 8 certificates, some form of rental assistance. So through 2011 then, we had an increase in Minnesota of about 26,000 households that were paying over half their income for housing. And that's an increase over that base of 111,000 households that started out in 2006. So that's the major theme I wanted to just convey to the committee, is that we need to come up with some new ways of getting at what's going on in the state. From last week when we had the homeless day on the Hill, you saw from the Wilder survey that there was a continued increase in the number of homeless families in Minnesota. That's another way of looking at the stress and lack of affordable housing. Minnesota is not going to resolve this problem by itself. I think we, as advocates for affordable housing, and I representing the Minnesota Housing Partnership, can only ask you to do what you can to be as creative as you can in addressing the need, and we'll, you know, make do as we can. But I hope to convey to you that there is a tremendous problem out there that affects every district of the state. That there's a shortage of affordable housing facing primarily very low-income families and individuals and elderly, and we just ask that the state, again, be as creative as it can to address that need, and that's represented in this legislation. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Halbach? Hearing none, do you have anyone else that would like to testify? They could come forward and please identify yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Committee members, I'm Tristan Mattis Castillo with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, and we also are testifying in support of this bill for a number of the same reasons that Mr. Halbach explained to you, but really we are positive about, you know, it's not a new tax revenue, it's not a raise to taxes, it's what's there already, and the fact that it would be an opportunity to dedicate funds that come from housing to housing to make sure all Minnesotans have affordable housing seems practical and realistic, and it's a way for us to recalibrate and set our priorities to first meet the need of housing so that we can get on and use the needs of other things like education and jobs. I know a number of you were on the tour last week, and that was a big aha moment. I know that we have several homeless folks and people in housing that they can't afford. They have jobs, but they still can't afford the housing, and so they're not in adequate shelter or dignified shelter. And so this is a great way to use funds that are already generated from housing and reinvested into the housing stock. That's
all I have. Okay, very good. Any questions for our testifier? Mr. Hertas, Representative Hertas, excuse me.
That's okay, Mr. Fisher. I was wondering if House Research has some information to get an idea for us to look at the revenues that are generated through state deed tax and MRT. What was the amount of inflow during the good times with regard to revenue? And I might reference to maybe the 10 years prior to 2007. I see that revenues, at least as laid out in this bill, is reserving by 2016-2017 $103 million of revenue, noting as little as 82.5 in 2014. But could you give us a little bit of a background on what the revenue stream was when the housing bubble didn't break?
Mr. Mary Mullen?
No.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry. Ron. Okay. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members, it has varied quite a bit. There have been some really high years, especially in the mid-2000s when things were kind of on the upswing and very rapidly. Actually, last year, or this fiscal year, is projected to be kind of another high threshold this year. And then it drops back next year, in the forecast at least. They're expecting it to drop back for the next 4 years and to stay pretty steady. That's the mortgage tax. The deed tax, on the other hand, is projected to go up quite a bit. And it has something to do with refinancing. I tried to get a reason why things were looking the way they were looking. And there's something to do with some kind of anomalies relating to some of the refinancing that's going on and some of the other things. But that's kind of but yes, In the mid-2000s, the numbers were quite high. These would be kind of on the lower end of those years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus.
I don't have the exact numbers. We can get the exact numbers. I do have downstairs, I do have exact numbers. I think they go all the way back to almost 1990 that I could get you.
Representative Hertaus. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my familiarity and involvement in the housing industry, some of the testimony we heard is correct. There are several states that do impose MRT and state deed tax, but it's a very small number. It's only about six in the nation that actually collect MRT and state deed tax. That said, I'm concerned a little bit in terms of the path of this and the way the language is that this could be maybe an unintended windfall should the housing recover. I would point out that during the housing boom in the 13-county metro area, just some data that I'm familiar with, the housing industry with regard to new construction was building in the 23,000 to 26,000 units per year. Currently, for the last 5 years, we've not been above 4,000 units in the metro. So that's about an 80% decline in a new construction housing industry. So that said, if these numbers are based on some forecasting, the reality is that even though we've had an excess of inventory and there's been foreclosures and there's been a depressed housing market, that trend line has now reversed itself to where we now have the lowest housing inventories in the resale market since 2003 or 4. And that said, it looks like the housing industry is poised for recovery. We also have a situation where young people are still graduating from college, they're still getting married, they're still having families. The need for housing continues, even though it hasn't been, new construction hasn't been happening to the degree that we were familiar with. So I guess my point is that if housing should recover and if the revenue stream was $150 or $200 million from MRT or mortgage registration tax or state deed tax, the way this is structured could be a huge amount of money that's flowing into housing if it's not revisited between now and then. And I have some follow-up comments, but I don't know if anybody wants to respond to what I've said.
Is there anyone that would like to, Representative Clark?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will respond on one level, and then I was just talking with our witness who might want to say some more, too. We had a presentation from the Homes for All about the kinds of need that we have in our existing housing community to deal with everything from homelessness to those workforce families who don't have housing in some parts of our state, to the elderly who need repair of their housing, and to very low-income people and kind of more middle-income people. Those numbers, as I recall, the $25 million that they were asking for the Homes for All from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency was really about $200 million in need. So I'm not too worried right now about us getting above a need level where we would have an excess. But I would say if we ever got to that point, we can certainly revisit it. At this point, we're so far below what the need is, about 10%, a little more than 10% of what the need is. And that's kind of a modest approach. We can, I brought a moderate bill forward, and the advocates did this year. And I've actually encouraged them to be sure to talk with people about what the real need is. And maybe I could ask if you want to say some more about that. That would be in response to your question.
Ms. Mattis-Casillo?
Close enough.
Not good.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hertaus. The current need, just for your reference, yes, $200 million would be a lot. It would be great, but it doesn't go far enough, even that amount. The current need annually, so not one-time funding, but annually, is $568.7 million to meet the housing need in Minnesota for affordable housing. So it'll be quite a while before we're revisiting that number.
Representative Hertaus, you said you had some follow-up?
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair and testifiers, you know, we've talked a lot in the Housing Committee about some of the things that have been impediments to creating more housing and more affordable housing. I had a little bit of an opportunity in a discussion in Chair Clark's office one time, but I'd just like to point out that some of the structures and some of the things we have in place are impediments to home ownership. Such as MRT and state deed tax. These are things that require extra monies and down payments, cash at closing, if you will, in order to close a transaction. When you're talking a median home value of currently right around $200,000, and with 10% down, you've got $180,000 times $3.30 per thousand, and then you got $2.30 per thousand on state deed tax. You're having to come up with well over $1,000 of extra cost just to close that transaction. Now, this is a big deal because when you're qualifying for a mortgage and you're taking on this additional debt, your qualifying ratios are 28% of short-term debt, maybe 33% of long-term debt. And basically, if you turn that around, if you're borrowing money at $6 or $8 a thousand and you've got a couple extra $1,000 of expenses up front, not only does it take more money in order to close that transaction and be able to save up enough money to become a buyer in the marketplace, but then you're also having to factor in the extra debt, and you're paying that debt over 30 years, and suddenly that $2,000 turns into $6,500 of additional costs and an extra $50, $60, $75, maybe $100 a month of income in order to qualify for a mortgage. So that's one example of some of the impediments that we create to make housing more affordable. But the bigger thing is what government does in terms of making opportunities to create affordable housing. I told Chair Clark that you know, in the development community, you would be laughed right out of a city hall if you came into a community proposing to create a subdivision on 50-foot lots, much of like the first suburban ring that many of us grew up in, including my own, where I lived, you know, in a modest home on a 50-foot lot. And much of Minneapolis was platted into even smaller lots, 40-foot wide lots. In the suburbs, you literally would be laughed right out of City Hall if you even thought of such an idea. And then we have regional government bodies that further interfere with the marketplace, that drive up the cost of land. And land is typically 25 to 30% of the cost of a new home. So we have this call upon you know, sustainable communities and livable communities and having to have parks and trails and all the amenities. We've got to have $30,000 streetlights in subdivisions instead of $6,000 streetlights. We've got to have sidewalks on both sides of the street. We make high standards in terms of landscaping requirements, and we create extensive home sites. And this is particularly discriminatory to people who cannot afford a home. These policies that local governments have and some of our bureaucracies are set up drive the price of land up, drive the cost of development up in all aspects of the whole process that fundamentally I don't think too many legislators understand. And if you really want to reform things and make opportunities for people to afford affordable housing, we ought to be revisiting some of these requirements. That was more of a statement than a question. Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify at all? Yes, go ahead, Mattis Castillo.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
Representative Hartas, I just want to respond to your comments because, you know, at Habitat for Humanity, we're always working within communities to make sure housing is affordable, and we feel those burden on local WAC and SAC fees and park fees and all of those things as well. And so you're very right. There are things that impede our ability to keep housing affordable. But on this particular bill, we're not proposing a new tax. It isn't a tax that currently is intended to make housing affordable. It goes to pay our general fund, and so it's being used on many other things in our community and our state, and so we're not proposing a new tax. But we are proposing that if we are going to have a tax on housing, then let's reinvest it into housing and the housing market and to make housing affordable for others so that those other things that might impede us can be worked on at the same time. But in the meantime, we're trying to direct those funds. thank you for your comments. You sound like a huge supporter of our affordable housing.
Thank you. Any further comments? Hearing none, Representative Clark renews her motion to have House File Number 1055 laid over to our next meeting.
Yes, and members, again, the amendment that we will be putting on the news should all have in your packet, so it's plenty of time to look at it.
Thank you.
Representative Portman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Clark and members of the committee. I hope that somebody on the committee would be willing to move House File 1377 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce.
I will make that motion.
Fisher moves House File 1377 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Housing Committee. I know you've already heard testimony this year on the foreclosure crisis, and that there's been a lot of people who have lost their homes over recent years. In the early part of the crisis, there was some scamming going on, and the Minnesota legislature acted to address that. And then we had a severe economic downturn, and a lot of people lost their homes due to losing their jobs. And as more and more people have faced foreclosure and been going through the process, we've learned that there are some things that could improve in the process. There has been, of course, a lot of federal activity in the area. And in looking at state law, we want to make sure that we have the appropriate balance between protections for homeowners, but understanding that mortgages are a contract between two parties, and that there are rights to enforcement for the banks and other lending entities that enter into those contracts, and that the actions we take in the state legislature, we protect homeowners, but we balance the rights of those who have an interest in the property other than the homeowner. So with that, I would like to have Ron Elwood from Legal Aid explain to you what my bill does.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and it's a pleasure to be appearing before you once again today. I wanted to appreciate the opportunity to present to explain this bill, and I appreciate Representative Portman bringing it forward. The purpose of the bill is pretty simple. It's really to try to make sure that people, homeowners who actually can keep their home, who have the ability to pay and to potentially restructure the mortgage to do so, actually have the opportunity to stay in their homes. And I think that's certainly a goal that I know everybody shares across the state. I want to be really clear that this bill does not create one single new requirement or obligation at all. As you've heard already through other testimony and other bills, there are a lot of things that have already been done. There's the National Mortgage Settlement that you know that has imposed some, or their folks have agreed to do things, certain things. The CFPB rules that will be going into effect create various requirements. The federal programs that the Making Homes Affordable program, for example. So we're not creating anything new. What this bill simply does is create a mechanism to essentially give homeowners a tool to enforce those obligations that are already in place. And that's simply what it does. I think if you look on page 2, line 13, that's the bill, and it's simply the definition of loss mitigation obligations, in essence, refers to the kinds of things I just referred to, the rules that are in place, the consent agreements that are in place, and all those things. And it under current law, in the section that's being amended, there are already certain requisites for foreclosure. And this would add just one more to only those mortgages, to which any of these existing requirements apply. And that would be a requisite for foreclosure and provide the opportunity. The one thing that's missing in all of these things is the opportunity for the individual to actually enforce any of this stuff. And so the rest of the bill is really cleanup of some notice requirements. Section 2 of the bill will, you know, the existing statute requires foreclosure advice notice and how to reinstate your mortgage up until the point of the sale. The statute actually requires that kind of information to go all the way through to redemption when it's already too late. So this is really just cleaning it up and saying you don't have to send notices when those notices no longer make any sense. And I think we want to delete 3.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would also be hopeful that somebody on the committee would be willing to move to strike Section 3. We have heard from folks in the industry that Section 3 doesn't necessarily add value to the bill. And so it deals with communications that the homeowner gets. And there's such a thing as too many notices and confusing notices, and maybe adding something else into the mix doesn't add value. And so, Madam Chair, if somebody on the committee would be willing to strike Section 3.
Let me find out first if there's any objection to striking a section from anyone. Anyone object? Okay, so Representative Isaacson moves that we strike Section
2.31, is that correct, Madam Chair?
Lines 2.31
to lines 3.7? Well, actually, the only lines 3.5, the new language on 3.5 and 3.6.
Yeah. It gets rid of the whole section. I think that the proper motion is 2.31 to 3.7.
Can you give me that one more time, please, so we can make sure we get that?
Sure. Strike lines 2.31 through 3.7.
Any questions about that?
Yeah.
Okay. We need a clarification for House Counsel. Are you striking the whole section or just the new language? You're striking the whole section of existing law and new language.
No, just from the bill. We're striking Section 3 from the bill, not striking any existing law.
That's a different amendment. Yeah.
Ms. Mullen, is
it's
that
late.
Makes any sense? Okay. All right. Any discussion? Representative Hertas.
So then you would need a motion to resection the remainder of the bill?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding that revise or renumbers after we do whatever crazy stuff we do in the committee.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In talking with some folks this afternoon, there was a concern with the one small part of this bill. Does this amendment to take care of the concern of some of the bankers or credit unions?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, no, this does not. But we have been in very close conversations with the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Independent Bankers, Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the Minnesota Credit Union Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and the Real Property Section of the Bar. And there will be additional work done. We've been working on already. They've made some incredibly constructive suggestions, which we've already started to adopt into a new amendment, which would be at the appropriate stop, the next stop. So I think that's in process.
Any further discussion? Okay. Do you want to read back the language just so we make sure the motion, so we're sure everybody's clear on it?
Sure. Yeah, the motion made by Representative Isaacson was to strike Section 3 from the bill, and it would be renumbered by the revisers.
Okay. Any further discussion? Not. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is adopted.
And then, Chair, members of the committee, the final section is really another one of those cleanups. There's been, over time, a lot of concern about referring to various websites that can change and links. And so this is a good example of one. This link doesn't exist anymore, so we're removing it and simply referring to the general website of the agency. And we're hopeful that that's not going to change. That's pretty safe. So that's a highly technical, but just so you understand what we're doing there. And that's the gist of the bill. So I do have a staff attorney from Legal Aid, Colleen Daly, with me who works on with clients every day facing these situations, and she is here to answer any questions of a technical nature that I might not be able to handle. So with that.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Daly. Any questions? Representative Hertas.
Madam Chair, is there anyone from the Bankers Association here to testify on this?
Yes, I think if there's anyone who in the audience who wishes to testify for or against it, please come forward. And I think the specific request from Representative Hertas, is there anyone from the Bankers Association who wishes to testify? Who chooses to testify? Representative Hertas.
If not, I was going to ask the testifiers to identify what issues they are discussing with the bankers.
Okay. Mr. Elwood, would you like to take that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, yes, I'd actually be happy to do that and glad that you asked. The issues that we are going to hone and clarify and tighten would be on the first page on lines 1.212 through 1.121. The concept is, as I said before, if you're under an obligation, a statutory or regulatory obligation, or under a consent agreement, simply just do what you've agreed to do or required to do. But the concerns that were expressed, and I think they're absolutely correct, is that this is just a little too broad and vague. And what we are in the process of doing is being more specific to be more bright line. And here are the specific things that you need that we're referring to make it clear so there's everybody knows the rules of the road. It's not too overly broad. And that, I believe, is the gist of it. Yep.
I'm seeing a shaking of the head from the.
Thank you for that explanation.
Anyone else from the audience or from the committee questions? If not, I believe the bill is before us as amended. House Bill, Representative Isaacson's motion, House Bill 1577, to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to Commerce Committee. Thank you so much. So, committee members, I think that concludes our bills for tonight, and we'll be seeing y'all. Thank you very much.